Like they appear on the page like this with the axis again, just like the other. By the way, yeah, it's at the back somewhere. Yes, this is what he says. It says this: poetry is a muscular principle, and a revolution for the body, spirit, and intellect and ear. Making images and pictures, even when speaking with melody, is not enough. Making images and pictures, even when speaking with melody, is not enough. There must be a poetry of pure beauty and energy that does not mimic, but joins and exalts reality and stakes up daily higher vision. To dim the senses and listen to inner energies or roar is sometimes called the religious experience. It doesn't matter what it's called. And then he talks about the tantric theories about organizing the energy inside your body. And then he says, these are spontaneous stanzas published in the order and with the natural sounds in which they were first written. And then he talks about the relationship between the invented language and the straightforward English. And then says, the pronounced sounds, as they are spelled, is what he's concerned with. And he gives you advice how to read it. And he says, these sounds are pronounced as they are spelled. Don't worry about the details. Let individual pronunciations and vibrations occur. And don't look for secret meanings. Read them aloud, and there will be more pleasure. And these poems are very much meant to be like performed for yourself, not in a public hall. We looked at some poems of Robert Creeley earlier on, I think, remember? And Creeley, I was talking to Creeley about this, and he was saying how astonished he was when he first read these to himself in a pretty echoey bathroom. Mm-hmm. And the extraordinary feeling of release across the diaphragm as you do let these sounds vibrate in your body continuum, which is like pure tantric ideas, these ideas of getting your particles in your body structure to vibrate properly and in a releasing sense. Now obviously this is a dimension of poetry which is very familiar to people living in India, but certainly it's not in the least familiar in any sense to the West during the last few years, because again, this is the extreme opposite of the poem on the page to be analysed, this kind of idea of poetry. There's something else going on here. And this stuff doesn't exist really except in performance, obviously. Because until you sound to make the sound, such as your body vibrates, and the air in front of your body vibrates, and you meet the vibrations in the other person's body, nothing has happened. All you've got is an inert libretto for something in front of your eyes. So it would be an extreme difference there. But the strange thing is, it's very public the way he does it, but it can be used very privately too, is what one wants to say. It's a question of using techniques in the way that they're available in that particular way. So it may sound a very public poetry, but in actual fact, it can be a very private one indeed. But certainly it's religious in the sense he's suggesting it. If by religion we mean finding out what the structure of energy in the universe is and using it. Which I think is the definition of religion, I suppose. And that's the kind of thing that's going on.
Do you think one of the reasons for the reproduction of the handwriting is analogous to the problems of notation and music?
I think it is. I think there's a problem here there is a tremendous problem all the time in notation. It's one of the biggest problems there is in poetry and in music. And that is, what sort of notation for performance do you put on the page? We were discussing this in connection with Charles Austin earlier. I mean, one of the biggest questions you have to ask all the time these days, ask yourself when you're writing poetry at all, is, okay, where does the line end? And why did it end there? If you're not filling a pre-existent mould in that way. So, in these poems of Michael McClure's, again and again, you'll see, I don't even see from there, but that line there is just like G, R, and then there's a whole string of O's, and then R at the end there. How long you make that last in terms of sounding it out, projecting the sound, will depend very much on the value of each of the vowels and all the rest of the words. That is, until you decide on the speed of reading, the range of vowel sounds, on how long the vowels will last, on how you'll pitch your voice, on how loud you're going to use it, and how much energy at every point you're going to project out using the projective verse theory we saw in Olson. If you've decided all that, nothing will happen. So the notation is really a libretto there for performance. And this is the way the poetry must be, I take it, that in every case, you've still got to perform it for yourself. And there is no, like, limiting of, even the most strict mathematical form still has the problem of being performed. I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, you know, rhymed heroic couplets. One asks, well, how quickly do you read them? I mean, if you read them at the diabolic speed, they would come out like a jingle. If you read them very slowly, it would probably be almost impossible to recognize that they were rhymed heroic couplets. Mm-hmm. You see? So what is the relationship? So even in the most mathematically structured verse, there's always this problem. And anybody knows, you know, who's played tapes and records knows that it's sometimes an absolute revelation. I was talking to somebody the other day about this. We had a mutual experience on this. A student had been playing the, where was it? Oh, I was down, yes, the University of Wales last Tuesday. Somebody was talking about that they're playing a Roller Stevens record. How astonished he was that it was so slow. And it is, it's weird to hear, if you, the first time you ever hear Roller Stevens read his poem, the sheer slowness of it. It's as if something like the space around the words. And you would suddenly realize you've obviously read the poems all the time, far too quickly, and therefore wrong. That is, the way the words are supposed to be shaped. He had a very clear idea. Until you hear them performed, it's very difficult to know. These are the problems as between notation and performance that we're into. I don't think there's any, like, you know, I don't think there's any ideal of this, by the way, that you invent some kind of technique of knowing absolutely at all. But I think there's no reason why you should. What we're talking about is, okay, what is performance? What is notation? So that we know the field we're in. And that's all you can know. And in John Wheeler's case, it's very curious because the sheer clumsiness of the reading. I mean, actors, you know how actors talk about poetry reading. They can't bear poetry reading poetry because it isn't slick.
Yeah.
And you know, when an actor reads poetry, it's so accurate you could scream. It isn't poetry at all. It's an acting performance. Always. Without exception, I've never heard an actor read poetry as it should be read, ever. It's always performed as an acting performance. So one's always concerned there with, okay, what is the poet doing? And how much are we going to put up with clumsiness? And at what point does it become a bad reading? Or what is a bad reading by a poet anyway? Because it's always his performance. You see, I'm just suggesting the area of the questions we have to ask. And sometimes John Wieners is obviously completely out of his head for one thing or another.
If poetry is performance, if the reading's really bad, is that bad poetry?
I think one has to decide what is the bad performance, as I said. I was just asking a question. I think there are ways of deciding this, for me at least. I mean, if there are elements in the printed text which you recognise, say, which are, you admire intensely, and it doesn't come out in the performance, either you're wrong or he is, you see. Or if, in fact, you've heard the poet read before, and it was much clearer, shall we say, or he seemed to give more value to the elements that are recognized in the text, and so on. I mean, but that's all. I mean, those two performances of John Wheeler's there, the first one, in this very close, tight acoustic, where he seems to be like breathing his body into the microphone, like, very close to you. And then the other one, which is a bit further away, there's the same effect of the same, the fact that this guy inviting you into his life quite a bit through the expression of very intimate actions in that particular way, which is completely unlike Michael McClure inviting you to let your bodies vibrate together. And I played them together because it's very strange. When you play them together like that, you get the feeling that John Wieners is much more cerebral than you ever thought. You know, it's a very curious effect because Wieners gives the impression of being very fragile in his voice, you know, doesn't he, when you hear him? It's just like very vulnerable, like bare sort of feeling. The title of his book, Nerves, is a good title. I mean, you feel a man there on his nerves, right? And Mike McClure, you don't feel that, do you? You feel the guy with tremendous confidence, like bellowing out these ghost answers, you see. In fact, bellowing them out to gain confidence, which he gains, because that's part of the religious technique of the thing.
Remember a few years ago how many people thought that Dylan Thomas was the best reader of their poetry there was,
yeah.
Because he sounded the most like an actor.
Right. I still think that. I still think it's abominable. But the, not very much like Dylan Thomas, but I'm very prejudiced. But I think the way he reads his poems is quite awful.
I thought so when I heard it.
But still, I mean, again, that is the way the poem should be read, clearly, because that's the way he wanted them read. He wanted them read in that weird upper-class accent, apparently, and he wanted them read with that incredible rhetorical stress on a certain musical range, rather than intellection, and so on. Okay, that's the Dylan Thomas poem, I take it. Yes. Well, but he's such an upper class accent. It's so weird. You know, I mean, he sounds like. When he, did you ever see?
It's going to be the Welsh limb, though, hasn't it? You know, I mean, like he always wanted that. You know, with Burton reading it as well. You know.
Yeah. But you know what I mean, though. There's this extraordinary, you know, down there public school accent in the man, which is I found very disconcerting. But apparently, that's what how he wanted to read. The best performance he ever did was reading Satan in Paradise Lost, in the third program back to Milton's poem. And he said, I'd just like you to think, you know, a sort of decayed public school sixth form. No, really, I mean, I think that's what Milton Satan is a bit like in some way.
Yeah, like Trouble in Paradise.
Yeah.
You know, that very greasy chap in the evening dress.
Yeah. I don't know, I think, you know, what I'm saying is that the invitation to poetry, the invitation to partake in it, is what we have to get at. Maybe that's what I mean by performance. What kind of invitation is there? What kind of acoustic space are you drawn into? And then what kind of participation? Is it to see yourself reflected in a very hard surface, or is it to be drawn in to someone who seems to be incredibly vulnerable and is reaching out to you? That would be the two extremes here, I take. But certainly McClure's poetry moves towards surface, toward very hard surface sound surfaces, continually in his work. And finally, his most recent poems, he's still working, not recent, but the one about 2 years ago, were certainly still working in that area of stylization. I mean, long sequences of poems about Jean Harlow and Billy the Kid, like statements by mysticized creatures. It's a very curious kind of verse he's into. And he himself looks very sterilized with his leathers and his hair done just so, and his sort of bike boy atmosphere about him. As if he wanted to hide inside, you know, get inside that kind of armored vision of myth, in fact. And then cry out from it, you know, project from that area. He's fascinated by this thing. One of his very earliest works was on Billy the Kid. I discovered this the other day. We played in San Francisco and way back in the very early 50s. Okay, I want to play a bit. I'm going to Xerox some of these McClure things, and I'm going to play a bit more of Michael McClure next time. And then it'll be the last session next week, won't it? Yes, it will be. Okay. Detail this time, it needs a very important manner to get ourselves straight up, because I didn't do it to my third chapter at all last time. Right, well, it'll be okay for you then, because you didn't hear it. Now, these poems here, these come from Mad Song. These ones in his own handwriting are printed in a big book about this size. And were written out like this in his own handwriting. And that's in a book called Mad Sonnets, which came out in 1964, 13 Mad Sonnets. And the other poems are from a book, the printed ones, are taken from a book called Ghost Tanfers, which came out the same year, 1964. goes 10 to 64 and 39 sonnets 64. also, I mean, one of the things I'm concerned with then is another kind of performance variant is this calligraphic idea. Yeah. Philip Whalen does it, another major American poet does this kind of thing. That is, the sense of, not of the printed, of the poem printed impersonally on the page, but of the poem in an original calligraphy, an original handwriting. I think we ought to notice here that one of the ways in which notation has taken place in poetry that overlaps with fine arts is exactly here. I mean, if you say writing, it's like that. One just has to mean historically a whole range of things which consists of making marks on stone, like cuneiform, or the Book of Kells, or those Muslim arabesques, that are on Muslim mosques, where only stone calligraphy is allowed anyway, because imitation images of life were forbidden by the religion. There's a huge tradition in the East, particularly, but certainly in the West. You can see it in the Book of Kells, certainly there, of elaborate calligraphic structuring. That is, like in the front of a medieval manuscript, the D for Deo is given a big whoosh, all sorts of curls and fiddle-dee around. And this, but that extended into the whole sentence, say, so until all you can see is a block of calligraphic scribble and scrawl and design is what I'm concerned with. In Chinese, in Arabic, all over the world, writing in that sense of calligraphic elaboration to make a thing which can be read, but which is primarily language, is what we're concerned with. So that McClure and Whalen and other people who print their poems in this way are inside a very long tradition indeed. And of course, concrete poetry now, sound text poetry, concentrates very much on making an object which is readable and visible. And it's going an awful long way. My dear old friend Bob Cobbin gave us two poems this morning, which he announced to me he was going to read. And I just laughed, and I just couldn't say he could possibly read what he showed me. Because it was like signs, but they looked beautiful on the page. Lovely. I mean, really lovely. But he said he was going to read them at this festival in Sweden. I don't know how you read that. So the whole problem of notation is involved, you see. Bob says he can read it. Okay. I said, you bring back a tape, brother. We're in this whole realm, then, of performance, notation, signs, everything is called writing. And everything that is not called writing as well, and it's called, design structures, if you like. So we're into that. And I say that because I didn't want to think that Fleur is just like unusual or weird or something here. This isn't true. Although it's not entirely common, he said. And it's amazing how different it is when you... I mean, I was getting through a poem that I'm putting in the next issue of poetry by Allen Ginsberg, and it arrived in manuscript, and it was a very, very complicated manuscript, which had to be deciphered and typed out by me, I must say, for the printer. And when I typed it out, it looked kind of terribly dull. it struck me that the way he'd written it on the page with all the adjustments and corrections was far more exciting. It's a marvelous poem, anyway. But somehow the holograph of the thing was exciting. Very beautiful piece of work. He looked good in his writing. Do you see what I mean? And it's the same thing. I had a poem, long poem from Hugh MacDiarmid the other day. It was a 6-page thing, and it was more like sloping down the side. But it was really, there was something about the way it was written, which was certainly part of the performance, is what I'm saying, you see, in that way.
It's got a spontaneity,
doesn't it? Yeah, and it reeks of itself, It's not been put through the filters of impersonal print. Do you know what I mean? It's this kind of thing that is very interesting indeed. Very interesting indeed. So that we're concerned then with a special kind of area, calligraphic calligraphic verse, in fact, calligraphic printing, it's usually called. That the poet's calligraphy is part of the poetic action. Yeah, John.
One has an almost unconscious association of printed pages, there's typeset pages, with reading silently to oneself.
Right.
A kind of edification.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Why is it that the typing took over from the... from the written poem.
I don't know, there's a strange thing here. I mean, there's nothing in McLuhan anywhere on this, which is strange. I mean, everywhere in McLuhan there is the idea, and you know, in the people he draws on, like Innes and Chater and so on, about the changeover from script to print. There's a book by H.J. Chater, do you know, called From Script to Print. That is the key book. And it's C-H-A-Y-T-O-R. It's in a paperback. H.J. Chater, From Script to Print, is the key work. But that is historical. Nobody's saying, like, from handwriting to typewriting, you see. And we know that Hemingway typed his novels on a typewriter, which was chest high. So it's all typed here like this. I mean, that interests me an awful lot.
Wow.
You know, and typing, I don't know how, but I know, as a writer myself, that typing and handwriting are different actions. They just are different actions. And there's something...
Olson said something about this, didn't he? Mm. Using the typewriter as a...
In projective... in the projective verse essay, it says explicitly that there is this business of typing, making you aware very much of the transference of energy through the machine onto that page. It's somehow the stamping of those print things, a little tiny stamping of the print things, is an indelible action, do you know? And it's like, also I think that as printed page is associated with perpetuity and permanence, you know, that the action of transferring your insides to the page through the typewriter makes you very aware of the fixity and stability action that you're into, you know, that you're holding something down. And somehow handwriting is associated with letter writing. And unless you're kind of a maniac like Gide or someone, I mean, you don't think of writing, when you write a letter, you don't think of its permanence. You know, I think still that handwritten letters tend to be the action is a transitory action for most people. Unless you like, you know darn well there's a collector's waiting for it. This kind of a terrible action. But certainly there is this real problem. But at what point, I suppose, that as soon as typewriting began to be, typewriters began to be cheap, I suppose. I don't know what I'll answer, because most writers don't have much money. And you can't have, I mean, until you get a sort of typewriter, the reason which you can't have one, can you? I don't know what the other answer to that, but I'm certain that the typing action is a very different kind of action. And I think that it very interests me a lot, those poets who send me manuscripts, which are typed, and those who don't. It's very interesting that.
You're slightly tribal, aren't you, by typing?
Right.
You write something out, write it back, and type it out.
Yeah, but the actual composition with a typewriter, what about that? Is what Olson's talking about, you know. I mean, you actually compose at the time, right? These are the strange areas. Also, I think that again and again, poets who write long, skinny poems tend to type them, and poets who write thick poems with long lines tend to handwrite them. You know, I mean, Theodore Insulin, I've got in the next issue, writes poems which will go down like tails down the page, you know, just like a few lines. And if you handwrite it, the sense. It's odd because the unevenness of the lines looks curious. But when you typewrite it, the space between the letters is more or less the same. You know, and there's a sense of evenness in little lines which makes them stand in a kind of column on the page like that, you know? Gives them a kind of order. Whereas if you handwrite little lines, they don't have that column sense at all. You see what I'm saying? It's like Zhukovsky says that the poem is very much that visual aspect, always. And the visual element of what it looks like, what sort of stability it has. I mean, does it look scrawly, doesn't it, you know? But it happens. I mean, anybody who's had the experience of editing a magazine that you have to type out some people's manuscripts for knows darn well that it looks a transformed object. I mean, it looks just, it's odd, it looks different. And your attitude towards it is different. You know?
I find it's harder to change after I've typed when it's still a manuscript form.
I'm not so sure about that. I must say that. No, I'm not so sure about that one, John, actually. I think this is a very personal matter.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure.
When it was typed out, errors tend to leap to the eye more than.
Right. Also, I don't know. I find my own handwriting so awfully tiny and squishy that when the thing's typed out with lots of space between the lines, I can go at it and start working on the thing for me. So I'm concerned with that. But anyway, this is really that this. All I want to do is to indicate the area that we're into here. This is not. It's a bit more interesting and complicated than you may have imagined. Is what I'm saying. Having a poem, a book of poems like that, which is handwritten. But understand something we've not said yet. It's still printed. It is not really handwritten. This is important. You see what I mean? I mean, it's printed handwriting rather than printed type. So one has to make a distinction between print and then, like, type handwriting. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, this is because we're into that reproductive thing. I mean, this is not, you know, a medieval manuscript on parchment hand going from hand to hand with all dirty old monks and things. Whatever they did.
I was saying about the Book of Blake poems came out about a year ago or 2 years ago, with the pictures on the one side and the print on the other.
Yeah.
And it was so different, you know, with the kind of his conception of what the poem should look like, and yet just the bare print on the page.
Well, I never forget when I saw that tiger poem actually on the page with that funny looking pussy cat.
Yeah.
The bottom sort of smiling away. I mean, it was really like a sort of overgrown pussy.
The rose, you know, with the worm on the rose.
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't it strange?
It was just so,
And yet, by God, it works the other way, because I saw for the first time I was in America recently, somebody lent me some of the America poem. You know, the America of Prophecy, I think it's called. And I'd never seen the designs before. You know, because normally you see great watches on the page. In actual fact, in the design printing version, there are just a few lines inside, kind of last, you know, design space. And the difference is extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. Again, like, what I'm drawing attention to is, like, this whole area, which is never discussed in books of literary criticism. But never is it. You know? About what does it look like? What is its shape? What does the eye take up? You know? From the page.
That's the job of the art department.
Yeah. And this is why that's an enormous attack on sound text poetry and concrete poetry these days. Really vehement, the idea that somehow it isn't, that it has, you can't, you're not left alone with structures which are supposed to be transparent meaning vehicles. You know, I mean, the poem is supposed to be transparent. I find this teaching students an awful lot that the poem is supposed to be a transparent vehicle for ideas, basically, you know. And the extreme opposite would be a poem like a concrete sound text poetry, which isn't there until you read it aloud. So it just isn't there. And then what happens? The answer is sounds. And they don't have a heavy exegetical backlog to leak out. And this upsets people no end. Like the cover of the next issue of Poetry Review is in fact an Indian poem, which just says, Yah hey, right across like that, endlessly. And it looks like a block of sound, which is exactly what we wanted. The structure of the poem, which is a transliteration into an English poem, is done by two people, a poet and a designer. And they worked together, and it came out like a block, which is exactly how you hear it when you hear Indians chant it. Do you see? Just like that. So I'm deeply concerned with this thing, as you can see. It's like on the cover, it's like capitals, you see, right across the page. And it comes out weirdly. When you look at it, you can almost hear the block sounds of that chant of the North American Indians. You see what we're concerned with. That kind of thing, then. It's to do with style, stylization, quite a bit. Okay, and the other that was the thing I wanted to mention there. And I'm going to read you some notes that I made, please, if you don't mind, for once, on Michael McClure, which is the beginning of a long essay on McClure that I got myself involved into. I did a long thing in the Science of Suffering once, but it's wildly out of date, so if you come across that, I'm sorry. Let's go back to the San Francisco Time. He's one of that West Coast crowd. And McClure's awareness of his difference from the poets that were in San Francisco at that time. And I'm quoting to you from Donald Allen's New American Poetry Anthology in the back of it, which is page 423. And he makes a distinction between himself and Charles Olson straight away. If Charles Olson's is poetry of the intellect and physiology, I want a writing of the emotions, intellect, and physiology. The direct emotional statement from the body, from the organs, and from the energy of movements. You see, he's like challenging the projective verse statement. A direct emotional statement from the body. The intellect will be the wit, discipline, and truth of it. Intellect is a means toward aiding the felt, the field, through the typewriter. This is one has to read this as a variation played on the projective verse essay, you see? A very explicit one in 1958. The intellect is a means toward aiding the felt, the field, to the typewriter, as far as McClure is concerned. This is in the essay in the Allen Anthology. If you read any later materials of McClure, you'll see that he moves a lot from that point quite a long way into the what he calls divine ecology. McClure's poems are usually statements of the movement of the body among other bodies or in nature, with insects, with leaves, with animals. And he's very conscious. He wrote a book called Meat Science Essays, of the body as meat, he calls it. It's like, he means by that simply taking the curse off the word flesh, which has such moral overtones in discourse. And the idea of meat then associates the body's meat with other kinds of flesh. Meat science to him is again that the place of the felt. It's the place of the emotions. It's not the brain so much as the body. But you must be careful here, because he's very conscious, just as Olson and the others are, of the historical process and the political instance of this. I must say, because he has written a poem called Poisoned Wheat, which is an attack on Vietnam, on the Vietnamese War. That's 65. But, you see, it's typical of McClure that when he rejects the Vietnamese War in the Poisoned Wheat, he goes further. And the appeal to young people and many others in America of this is important. He's saying, I will not be guilty of this war or any other war. Don't you tell me I am. I am not. This is absolute refusal, absolute rejection of guilt for the Vietnam War in this poem. And its perpetrators. He refuses both capitalism and communism politically, and he refuses that awful thing that we all get ourselves into, you know. You know, when the blacks come on and say to us, you're responsible for 400 years of slavery, and one's immediately, my immediate reaction is, I am not, you know, and I know I'm not. Absolutely and fundamentally, I know that. I'm with McClure on this one. I want to be free of that so I can move on, you know. And Poisoned Wheat is a very important poem. It's in his very last book called Star. I forget when that came out. It's 1970. It's paperback. Okay then, he's aware of the process, but then as a load of guilt, but as a possibility to move on from. Let me quote you what he says in 1965. Some days I am totally with my senses, and everything is sharp and clear. Today I can barely recall the sheer real joy of a cherry blossom, the flaring of the intellect into the depth of the body, where there is a oneness with all the dark figures of life, and without the sacrifice of each individual animal life. Today I am me inside. It no longer matters whether me is everything or me is individual. Tomorrow I will be individual again. I will be better for this living. Today I cannot remember things, for I am filled with shapes so large they become one and vague. I am happier in that other burning state. I know the other state better. Comfort is not the end of life, but we must all have pleasure. Poetry is pleasure, for it is the highest equation of our experiences. I am the keeper of beauty. I am a man. My name is Michael. I love you if you are beautiful. You must forgive me. I go away at times. I am difficult, but I will return to you the loveliness of your senses. And the relationship with the painters of the time in the San Francisco area and the writers, you can see in the title section of a book called Hymns to St. Geryon. It's G-E-R-Y-O-N, Hymns to St. Geryon. There he allies himself with the painters of Franz Kline, Jackson Pollock. He says, his interest in gesture, he's interested in making the gesture on the page with the language. That's why the calligraphy interests him. He wants to be like the painters. I quote. And he wants to make just this kind of act. We are committed to an unqualified act. Not illustrating outworn myths or contemporary alibis. One must accept total responsibility for what he executes. And the measure of his greatness will be the depth of his insight and courage in realizing his own vision. Demands for communication are presumptuous and irrelevant. This is the importance for him then. We are committed to an unqualified act. That calls for courage. To make an unqualified act is a very difficult thing to do. And then one must be totally responsible for what one executes. And then later on in the same poem, to clothe ourselves in the action, to remove from the precious to the full swing, to hit the object over the head, to step into what we conjecture. I am the body, the animal. The poem is a gesture of mine. The poem for Bicler, that is essentially that the body's gesture, the thing that it makes out of itself, whether it's visual or oral. And the invitation is into pleasure. And the concomitant word to meat he uses is the possibility of what he calls spirit meat, sometimes called the body-mind continuum. It's what the mammal can do. He uses the word mammal an awful lot. He tries not to use words like flesh and human being, but meat and mammal, to give us that sense of our relationship with other kinds of beings. And his opposition then to the body-mind dualism and all those Puritan separations is total. And one way to sense that oneness of the body is to generate what he calls the spirit meat in tantric exercises. That is, exercises which make the body the free mammal, to use his words. So these ghost tantras are sound gestures which the body is invited to make for pleasure, but they're also training for living as mammals in pleasure. I think that is the main point about those things. Okay, so the problem is the notation. He calls it the notation of letting go. And he uses a range of things, of typography, of capitals, exclamation marks, dotted lines, you can see, in whatever seems necessary. I quote, the prime purpose of my writing is liberation. Self-liberation first, and hopefully that of the reader. And everywhere in this theory goes this idea of the poetry helping the reader to enact some kind of ecstasy. I quote again, notation, varied line lengths on usually an axis, a plume or fountain. And I mentioned this last time, but again and again, his poems, like on an axis, like that, you can see. And the ones that I put in the first of the issues of my editing of Poetry Review, in the Poetry Review of Autumn last year, you'll see the poems, in fact, they're shorter lines, but they're on a kind of axis. And you can see them as of trees or plumes or fountains. That structure, you know, because those three things are on axes, right? So the lineation may look conventionally of unordered lines, but if you think of an axis down the centre, then the thing is even. Do you see? It's a way of saying, okay, the axis isn't the margin with things going from the left outwards, right? But the axis is the centre of the page. This is an invitation in. When you look at a tree, and when you look at a fountain, and when you look at a plume, it's a very tactile invitation, isn't it? To move into that running up and down space with the things going out. You're drawn in much more than that left to right action. And he uses dotted lines and ruled lines and italics and space and so on. And I quote you another thing he says about one of his poems. The poem could easily become a body, with elbows, lymph systems, muscles. Now, to understand, this is not a pattern game. This is not a visual pattern game, although, of course, visual is important there. It's a question of articulation, of making a gesture. Now, what he means by madness, and in the question of these mad sonnets, is that extreme case of liberation and ecstasy, that's all. If you read R.D. Lang's Politics of Experience, the opening part, you'll see exactly the kind of thing that McClure is getting into. You know, nowadays Lang and many others are saying, okay, like, you have to let go to get through the boundaries. Be mad. Be ecstatic. Now, McClure's been into this for some time now. And if you look at The Penguin of page of The Politics of Experience of R.D. Lang, on page 43, you'll see what I mean. I'm going to quote from R.D. Lang here. Words in a poem, sounds in movement, rhythm in space, attempt to recapture personal meaning in personal time and space. From out of the sights and sounds of depersonalized, dehumanized world, they are bridgeheads into alien territory. They are acts of insurrection. They are sources from the silence at the center of each of us. That would seem to me to be it wasn't meant this way. It's an extremely good description of McClure's work. And let me quote to you again, Lane. Madness need not be all breakdown. It may also be breakthrough. It is potentially liberation and renewal, as well as enslavement and existential death. That brings me to the other side of McClure, that is, he's concerned with the Hell's Angels and with what I was talking about last time, the mythicization of human beings into stars or myths. And so he's written a whole series of poems about Gene Harlow, the Hollywood star of the 30s, and Billy the Kid, and a play called The Beard about those two people. There's another kind of action that interests him then, that is the absolutely fixed, eternally stylized, the thing that can't change at all, and therefore is eternal. So the play, The Beard, takes place in eternity. It's an endless, endless discussion, endless conversation between Gene Harlow and Billy the Kid, two forms of American fixed myth. And the book he wrote on the Hell's Angels is similar. He understands very well that the uniforming of the angels and their stereotyped actions is another American mythicization. The book is called Freewheeling Frank. To Grove Press book about the angels in the Sample Square. I think those are the kind of things into let me just quote you something, a couple of other American poets on McClure, one of whom we played in this term, Robert Creeley. McClure, I would say, is intensely admired by people who don't write in a bit like him. And Creeley says about the kind of thing that McClure is into. He gives to his language a space, a flux in language, held by a structure of words, not a program of predetermined measures, either metrical or ideological. It is in this way as much his risks. It is in this way as much his risk as it is ours in reading to undertake a composition. It is in this way as much his risk as it is ours in reading to undertake this composition. McClure, reading aloud, I'm still quoting Creeley, McClure, reading aloud, speaks flatly, without colour, so that the words fall into relationships which they themselves, almost alone, seem to determine. In the poems, capitalization is used for diverse lines as a point of enlargement, a centre or a focus for the movement. The movement of the poems makes clear an insistent disattachment, a recognition of distance qualified as separation. There is a vacuum all but entered by purpose, form and consequence. What McCreary is getting into here, there's a strange feeling that McClure's poems don't relate to anything except themselves. They like come out of his body, and then the invitation is like, okay, what do you recognize? Just that. And Edward Dorn, who is a contemporary American poet of considerable power, says, if anything, McClure is a master of the ebb and flow of a poem. In fact, one of the great pleasures in reading him is to put oneself in his current. That seems to be very shrewd. In fact, one of the great pleasures in reading McClure is to put oneself in his current, and I think that's good. That's exactly what you're asked to do. I quoted to you where he challenges Olson's idea of intellect and physiology. Let me just finally quote to you what he says about the ghost tantras in 1964, which I'm going to play, and then I'll play you the tape. This is McClure's outstanding collection of body poetry, in fact. You're meant to do it yourself, in fact, like chant the things somewhere around and feel the action. Get the vowels out. And he says about ghost tantras, poetry is a muscular principle and a revolution for the body, spirit, and intellect and ear. To dim the senses and listen to the inner energies, a roar, is sometimes called the religious experience. To dim the senses and listen to the inner energies, a roar, he's very aware of the fact that one of the main actions of tantric theory, of Gurdjieff, of the great deal of yoga, is to listen and be aware of your body. Blake was into this one, you know, about cleansing the doors of perception. He says, there are no laws for living, there are no laws but living, changing ones. Any system is a touch of death. Read these poems as you would Lorca or Mayakovsky or Lawrence, but read aloud and sing them. These are spontaneous stanzas published in the order and with the natural sounds in which they were first written. Pronounce the sounds as they are spelled, and don't worry about details. Let individual pronunciations and vibrations occur, and don't look for secret meanings. Read them aloud, and there will be more pleasure. And on this tape, made at Buffalo, he actually says, in 68, he says, these poems are a series of songs as tantric practice, so that he's concerned with the magical evocation of the energies of the body, as tantric poems are. And he again advises people to read them, use a natural voice, and let the vibrations occur. They come from a swirling ball of silence that melds with outer sounds and thought. Their purpose is to bring beauty and change the shape of the universe. A goddess lies coiled at the base of man's body, and pure tantric sound might awaken her. He's referring there to the theory of tantric art, which is if you chant these what are called mantras, technically, that is sound structures, you awaken the body's centers of energy, which are called chakras. This is the theory of Kundalini yoga. That is, experts in mantra make sound vibration structures. You've heard of Pat Allen Ginsberg doing it when he's chanting Om, or Hare Krishna, or something of that kind. Now this is a neurochemical action. It isn't anything to do with like anything else at all, fundamentally. It is to do with realigning the particles of your body by making them vibrate. And then you get this relationship between the particles inside your body and the particles outside your body, vibrating together. Let me just quote one final thing from an essay called Revolt, which is in Meet Science Essays. I see liberty as the possibility of constantly achieving new experience without hysteria or fear-caused chance-taking. It's pretty good. I see liberty as the possibility of constantly achieving new experience without hysteria or fear-caused chance-taking. It's an essay called Revolt in Meet Science Essays. Okay, I wanted to get that off my chest because I think last time I didn't do proper justice to myself, who I admired very much, not like everybody else.
Are they called Meet Science?
Meet Science Essays.
Meet Science.
Meet Science. S-C-I-E-N-S-C. Meet Science Essays. It's published by Sid Light's father. Very interesting. There's a marvellous passage in that which I just love, where he talks about watching cockroaches and how beautiful they are, like with their feelers, and how they like touch each other and make love and so on. Which is, you know, we know how cockroaches are. I don't know how you feel about them. I think like every other human being in the world, somehow cockroaches are just not on.
But after the Carlos Williams autobiography, I can't
right. And I don't know what it is about cockroaches, but there's something which is absolutely grim. But they're in the science essay. There's an extraordinary passage of like affection for these beasties, which moved me an awful lot when I read it. I also have a marvellous tape, which I ought to have brought and I forgot. Of him reading these tantras to the lions in San Francisco Zoo. And they all start to roar in appreciation all around him. It's an extraordinary tape. It was made early in the morning, and they're all like, yes, it's terribly clear. They're purring, really. But there's not the slightest sound of aggression. You know what I mean? that they were in fact like listening to those like animal meat sounds coming out of them, like in a in the zoo. Okay, let's place the thing at your disposal.
You want to turn it around because you've got the speaker pointing towards the blackboard.
What's that side then?
That's just ventilation.
No, thank you, John. I didn't realize at all. I played these last time, and I think we'll just about just go on and play these and, for 20 minutes or so. He reads, in fact, the mad sonnets there, and then I think I've got the right ghost cantos afterwards, so you can follow them this time. There we go, no sonnet we have. Have I got it right? Yes, I have. I only bought that last time, didn't I?
The plumes of love are black. The plumes of love are black and delicate. Oh, and shine like moron-eyed plumes of a peacock, with violet shine and yellow on shadowing black. They spray from the body of the beloved, veins shaking in air. And I do not want black plumes or agony, and I do not surrender, and I ask for noble combat to give pure love as best I can with open heart. Love, I have not seen you before, and you're more beautiful than a plume, stately, striding in space and warm. Your human breasts, let me make your smile and heart-shaped face immortal. Your gray eyes are what I finally come to with my brown, and your high cheeks and your hair rough for a woman like a lamb and a walking virtue that you are.
Thank you.
Wow.
Schubert's at the bottom of 52 there.
Silence the eyes, become the senses, drive drool from the fresh repugnance thou hold, thou feeling creature, live not for others, but affect thyself from thy enhanced interior, believing what thou carry, thy trillionic multitude of bra, bhushans, and silences. Oh, you are heavier and dimmer than you knew, and more solid and full of pleasure. Bra. It's the mystery of the hunt that intrigues me, that drives us like lemmings, but cautiously, the search for a bright square cloud, the scent of lemon verbena, or to learn rules for the game the sea otters play in the surf. It is these small things and the secret behind them that fill the heart, the pattern, the spirit, the fiery demon that link them together and pull their freedom into our senses, the smell of a shrub, a cloud, the action of animals, the rising, the exuberance when the mystery is unveiled. It is these small things that when brought into vision become an inferno.
Right, well, you see the kind of thing he's into there. I think it is in connection with this whole thing we've been doing. I think it's important to notice that the what Robert Creeley said in that passage I quoted is very true. There's very little profile for the voice. It's deliberately like this flat chanting. So in fact the strange thing is the two kinds of action here. One is the tantric thing, which is designed very much to turn you on bodily, like the vibrations. The other kind of reading is very much like shamanistic statements of how it is, without any appeal at all to the body. Do you notice? They're extremely polarized here. I wanted you to notice that, if you will, because it's completely inside McClure's own performance. There are these two entirely different things. But a poet then can have at least two, and certainly in McClure's case, two entirely different kinds of performance action that way. I think it destroys all these ideas of the poet as a single action, you see what I mean? And McClure is the one case I know which is very clear, isn't it? That he has a completely distinct action here. No? Do you agree? This is an important matter. But there are two very important things happening. One is, like, he's as if he separated out two things that sometimes happen in poetry. That is, one of which is the sound text structure. So that you have, in fact, the appeal to your body sound, the muscularity sound structure of your body. And the other is the appeal to the articulation, the elegance of the articulation of feeling and ideas. And there's two entirely different things.
Has there been much overlap in composition between the two? I mean,
has there been?
Chronologically.
Well, I don't know. You see, I think that in the West, there's always been this aim to write what is called the lyric poem, which doesn't belong to any other culture, you know. I mean, to say lyric poetry to an Indian tantrist would be silly. You see what I mean? I mean, and those beautiful poems like, you know, Thomas Wyatt's, you know, the one where this one is about his bark, which literally was the gift from this one. Well, there's, and Yeats's things, you know, where there's this intense musical, lyrical ability. At the same time, a great deal of cerebration and intellection going on inside the action. So you get the ideal poem being that, you know. That is unknown outside Western culture. And certainly, I mean, they are the Indian things I'm talking about, or the shamanistic chants, which is, you know, it's designed to bring about magic. But in poetry, McClure separated two little things. One is the poem or statement of the conditions. The other is the magical idea. The other kind of magical idea, I'd say, because that's magic too. That if you name the thing calmly and keep naming it, it's there. The other kind is you invoke it by sound structures, you know, by like changing the particle structure, the particular structure of the particle. And then you invoke something else.
I mean, in McLuhan's case, has he written both types concurrently, or does he, or has
yes,
he?
Yes, concurrently. Very much so. Yeah. The good chapters came later, very much later. But since then, yeah. And there's this, and of course, then there's this third type thing going on in his work, which is these plays. I don't know, like the Beatles song, which I stylized and ritualized. His last thing called Gargoyle something or other, where the characters on the stage are so heavily made up and in such weird costumes that you can just about see the human in them. There's marvelous pictures in the paperback of the costumes, and then the voices come out of like the masked body. The stereotypes, in fact, you know. And what they say is something like the Tantric poems. That is, there's an invented language. Another play of his has like two strange creatures, undefined, on the stage, under an undefined looking tree, saying things to each other. He's penetrating very heavily into this magic area and dislocating you from reality all the time. You know, dislocating you from what you know.
It's like a new language in a way, isn't it?
Always.
Yeah.
These gargoyle poems, these gargoyle plays that he's done recently, as I said, the characters do speak to each other in their own language. Which is strange, because like it's a thing I think that secretly human beings would like to do. Because children do it. Mm. I don't think, you know, once you've done it as a child, you never lose anything. And one of my nieces like has her own language. My brother's very worried about it. I keep telling him not to be, but I don't really know anything about it. but she doesn't. She talks endlessly. She understands exactly what is being said to her, completely. But she has her own language. She will not imitate anybody else's sound. She just will not. And what you do about this, I don't quite know.
Maybe she's talking to somebody else.
Oh, she talks to you. She looks at you and kind of like, endlessly. And I was saying, like, moon. Finally, she did. And she said it in kind of this grumpled tone I gave up. She just said, moon. And then, and she was obviously disgusted by the whole thing of having to imitate for this stupid uncle, and then she had to say moon. Like, it was terribly obvious that she didn't care a tiny damn. But I think there's something, I mean, again, like one learns an enormous amount about what language is. You know, maybe it really is what McClure is saying, pleasure. You know, the body making its sounds, and the communication is irrelevant. You know, you see what the point I'm trying to make, that that child obviously feels that. Maybe there's this strange thing inside human beings that people just want to speak, they don't want to communicate with. Like all this catch and Chekhov's plays that don't talk to each other at all, they just all stand and say things. And it sort of goes out into the space, and then someone else beside them says something. They're not really conversing at all, are they?
That play last night,
they're just like...
The lie.
The Bergman.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's very similar, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not talking to each other.
We never said a bloody word to each other all night,
right.
You know, except for the end. Oh, no.
Yeah, weird. There was the cocktail.
And that was so physical.
It was extraordinary, like neo-Chekhovian play, you know? It's like,
it's so cold, the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I think Bergman is, actually. So that's all, yeah. But certainly, I think you... Oh, my God, I'm wound up. Certainly, McClure raises problems very much to me about... you know, all these things we're taught about the process and function of structured language. That it's meant to communicate, which means it's meant to communicate something, therefore there's something there to be communicated, therefore the job of the analyst is to find out what it is that's being communicated, and so on. You know, this kind of process. Whereas in fact it might be just pure articulation, it's supposed to enter your body. You know, in that way. Maybe. And certainly, in magic use of language and science and sound, it certainly is. And my old, dear old friend Bob Cobbing, I mean, when we did this miner's benefit up in Newcastle, he had the audience in, like, you know, a couple of minutes flat chanting all this sound structures. In this theatre. You know?
It's hard to do it.
Yeah. Well, he just like, he was announced, and he sort of like, he was standing, you know, at the back of the hall, and he started at the back of the hall, started chanting and doing all these noises and waving his hands and so on, and then walked right through the hall. And then he started like, then he maybe started, okay, now you lot over here sing this, and you lot over there sing that, and at point very carefully, very deliberately, and there's no like force everything up. And after we started that, when he sort of egged them on and bored with it, and admittedly Jeff and I helped a little, Jeff and I sort of, and we gradually everybody was there like, you know, chanting and shrieking and grinning. And it was obviously there was an enormous amount of pleasure was being generated, you see, by this. People hearing the sound of their bodies from me. Is there something in this?
Yeah. It can be done if the person who's leading it obviously is not embarrassed
right.
himself or, right. or doing a put on.
Right. I've done this in this at Kent State, you know, to do with the tape recording people's body sounds and so on. But graduate students who idea of poetry with exegesis and writing essays and things. And it was very disconcerting for them, first of all. And some people resented it deeply. But gradually we got it. And then of course they started playing back on their own student groups and we had those incredible noises all over the English department coming from. The aged professor saying, what have you done this time, Michael?
They're mad, all mad.
My God, he's done this time, okay, well, I'm not going to do any more, I'm not going to do any classes next term. I never do in the third term anyway.